Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. I know that on this Holy Saturday that many of our listeners will be more than aware that this, of course, this weekend and tomorrow in particular, Easter Sunday, becomes the most joyful of holidays in the Christian calendar. It is also not only a very significant Easter for the Irish diaspora, but it's also the centenary of the Easter Rising, the Rising in 1916, which brought Ireland its republic. I am delighted to go to Quinnipiac University, to go to Ireland's Great Hunger Institute, and to Professor Christine Keneally, who is the director of Ireland's Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac University. First of all, happy Easter to you, your family, and to our family at Quinnipiac.
And the same to you. Happy Easter to you and to Anya.
Let me ask you, Christine, first of all, you have, and Quinnipiac seems to be in full swing, full gear, in various exhibitions that are, taking place at Quinnipiac and at the campus in Quinnipiac pertaining to 1916, including the exhibition that we've been speaking about for the last couple of weeks here, The Seed of the People, 1916 in Ireland. Has that opened yet?
Yes. The Seed of the People opened on Wednesday, and it's free. It's open to the public, and it will run until the 30th of September.
Wow.
And that is really the centerpiece of all the activities that are happening at Quinnipiac. And if I could just mention some of the things that are on show at the exhibition. Just last week, we flew over from Ireland an original proclamation from 1916. So we're delighted to have that. It's on loan from Jim Callery of Strokestown House. But we also have...
Fabulous,
and
yeah.
It is fabulous. It's very beautiful, and I think for many people a very emotional, evocative document. But we also have a half proclamation, and I think many people may not realize, but because of the haste and the secrecy with which the proclamation had to be printed, the people printing it was actually printed by James Connolly and a team of printers in Liberty Hall on Easter Sunday. It was printed in secrecy and in haste. But they ran out of typeface, and so they printed the proclamation in two halves, and they left the bottom half on the printer. And when the British Army raided Liberty Hall in Dublin, they came across the bottom half of the proclamation, and they printed some out just as souvenirs. And in our exhibition, we actually have a half proclamation, which is on loan from Todd Allen of New Jersey.
Yes.
And the half proclamation is actually probably rarer than the full proclamation. But in our exhibition, we have both a full proclamation and a half proclamation.
Christine, that's talk about collector's item. That's really amazing. In addition, we'll come back to the details of the exhibition. I would like you, though, for the benefit of those who on this day, on Holy Saturday of 2016, to paint a picture for us of the atmosphere in Dublin at Easter in 1916. If you give us a starting point here.
Yeah. 1916, such a strange year because it occurred in the midst of a European war Many Irish men had signed up for that war, and as James Connolly said, they signed up due to poverty, not patriotism. There was heavy censorship, as we know, of all media at the time, and the rising was kept secret to such an extent it was actually kept secret from the head of the Irish Volunteers, Owen McNeill, who actually disapproved of the rising. The rising was due to take place on Easter Sunday, 1916. Roger Casement had organized to bring arms in from Germany. They were to land in Kerry, and he was intercepted and arrested. So the arms never arrived. The rising was called off by McNeill, and so it was sort of, in a way, slightly chaotic. But men like Pierce, like Tom Clark, like James Connolly said, no, we have to strike. If we don't strike now, it's never. So the Easter Rising actually commenced on Easter Monday with the reading of the proclamation by Pierce. Some historians now say it's Tom Clark, but traditionally we believe it's Patrick Pierce, just outside the General Post Office in Dublin on what is now O'Connell Street, was yes. then called Sackville Street. And you can imagine, you know, you're the centre of Dublin, but here's this man in military uniform outside the post office reading something, and people just didn't know what was going on. So it took many people, including the British, by surprise.
Now, when you say in military uniform, what was the uniform and what did it denote?
Pierce belonged to the Irish Volunteers. So this organization had been founded in 1913. And interestingly, they were founded because when, in 1912, the British government, you know, as a compromise, said, oh, Ireland can have independence, and they promised home rule for Ireland in 1914. Very, very limited form of independence.
Was that a verbal? Was there anything signed off on?
It was. It was part of legislation, and mm-hmm. it should have actually passed into law. It never, ever did.
Okay.
This is 1912, but unionists, mostly Protestants in the north, started to agitate against Home Rule. They didn't want any form of Irish independence. And so they formed their own military organization called the Ulster Volunteer Force, the UVF, and they started to organize as a militia, and they brought in guns from Germany. Edward Carson inspected them, and at that point, nationalists in the south said, we have to do something. So in response, they formed their own militia, the Irish Volunteers. So when Patrick Pearse and his followers went into the General Post Office on Easter Monday, he was there as part of the Irish Volunteers. But the other militia was headed by James Connolly, the Irish Citizen Army, which had been formed under different circumstances.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, women were allowed to be part of that organization as the equals of men. So Countess Markievicz was part of the Irish Citizen Army.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about what might be confusing 100 years later with respect to whether or not there was any level of coordination between, say, you know, the Common the Man, the committee, the Congregation of Women, and the Pierce crowd, so to speak.
Well, one great thing about Pierce was he was a feminist, and
yeah.
it was probably due to him that the proclamation said Irish men and Irish women. He had an incredible, powerful statement.
Yes.
So there was collaboration, but again, the problem always was, how do you do something in secrecy, because the British government was always watching them,
right.
and make it effective? So that was always the dilemma. So certainly Pierce and Tom Clark as well, and James Connolly, of course, were great supporters of the women and realized the power of the women.
Why outside of Dublin, in history will record that from once the declaration was signed, and the British forces were now well tuned into what was happening, and the destruction, by the British, because obviously the Irish did not have the heavy artillery that was brought in. Wasn't there a lot of agita? Wasn't there a great number of people who were highly annoyed with the rebels and figured that, you know, whatever was going to come out of this, their city center, their home, their homes and everything they held dear was being destroyed.
Yeah, and it was massively disruptive. So the general post office, it was a center of communications, but it was where people went to get their pensions, where they went to
right.
Their husbands were on the front, where they went to get their income. So in terms of communications, it was massively disruptive. And
right.
Dublin was a city that was incredibly, incredibly poor on the wake of the rising. People lived in tenements. Whole families lived in one room, shared water, shared toilet facilities. So incredible poverty in Dublin. And this just added to the dislocation,
yeah.
Poverty, the fact the insurgents took over, you know, Boland's Mills, the bakeries, etc. It just
yeah.
added to the disruption, the poverty, the hunger in the city. And then the British started to bombard. They sent up gunboats, and they destroyed the beautiful city centre. So for people who lived through it, it really seemed to be an act of wanton destruction. And for what? But then,
yeah.
As we know, within a few weeks, British public opinion turned against Irish public opinion turned in favour of the insurgents.
Not that suddenly, though. That took some time as you went through pockets in the country that were still in doubt as to whether this was even worth the effort.
It took some time, and again, we have to see it in the context of the First World War. Martial law had been declared in the whole of Ireland. There was a lot of censorship. So one of the things that we are doing as part of 1916 at Quinnipiac is we have the first edition of the Irish Times published in the wake of the rising. And we have digitized it, and in the next few weeks we're going to put it online and make it freely available. And just if you read it, it talks about the executions, but it says, James Connolly is in hospital being treated for his wounds. Actually, we know at that stage he's been executed, and that tells you something about the censorship of the time.
Boy.
But what we know is there was a general election in November 1916, the first time women could vote, and Sinn Féin won almost 3/4 of the votes. So we know that between the rising and between the general election, the mood had very much turned in favour of Sinn Féin and a total republic, total independence for Ireland, not home rule, a republic.
And if you can just maybe fill us in on what the mood of Ireland, the island of Ireland, was with respect to the northern, the six counties that were not part of the treaty, part of the deal.
Yeah, again, it's sort of interesting because, you know, the whole negotiations, what ultimately happened was without precedent. So the home rule that had been promised in 1912 was home rule for the whole of Ireland.
Right.
Obviously, the unionists, particularly in the north of Ireland, but all over Ireland, but more concentrated in the northeast, didn't want that. And there were, you know, talks about exclusions and maybe Ulster, and but nothing was determined. And obviously, if Ulster had been taken out of Ireland, there would have been a Catholic majority. And then in 1920, in the midst of the Tan War, the War of Independence, the British government passed legislation for the Better Government of Ireland legislation, and that included a clause for the partition of Ireland. And that meant that the six northeastern counties would be given a separate deal than the rest of Ireland. But what's interesting and sometimes forgotten is that the partition was only ever meant to be temporary until the two sides could reconcile and come to an agreement through a Council of Ireland. But that never, ever happened. The Unionists in the North refused to be part of that negotiation.
Not much would change for the bulk of the next 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the loose end which the various political parties in Ireland there was enough blame there, and if there wasn't, you would depend on what your political affiliation was, primarily with the larger parties like Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, with respect to who should take the responsibility for that loose end, which was done again in haste. But I suppose that the half a loaf or the three quarters of a loaf was better than none. But again, a lot of people would take tremendous umbrage to that, to even go there or to have that loose opinion that said no. And hence we have the peace process, which for most of the last century would not have been even a possibility. It was the ultimate fly in the ointment. But it's the Easter, and this particular Easter and the commemoration is... I'm not surprised, indeed, that it is one of the additional features for Quinnipiac University and for John Leahy, with Ireland's Great Hunger Museum and your directorship of Ireland's Great Hunger Institute. Again, the exhibition, Christine, the Seed of the Seat of the People, 1916, yep. In Ireland. That's actually on campus. That's in, tell us where.
It's in the Arnold Bernhardt Library. It's Monday to Saturdays, 9 to 5, Sundays, noon to 5. It's free. If people want to contact us in advance, we can organize tours. And, just the Seed of the People, it actually comes from a very beautiful, beautiful poem by Patrick Pearse called The Rebel. And we have the proclamation, the half proclamation, a letter by Connolly, a check by Pearse. We have a lot of really beautiful artifacts that tell the story. And, of course, we pay tribute to the women of 1916.
And rightly so. Professor Christine Keneally, Director of Ireland's Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac University. First of all, thank you for joining us not only today, but numerous times during the year to bring us up to date on what is happening and indeed giving us so much information, as we have with Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, but your directorship of the Institute is definitely going from strength to strength, and we congratulate you on that.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
On our website, irishradio.com, we will give you, friends, the links to Ireland's Great Hunger Institute and bring you up to date on all of that. Do you want to give... A specific website other than www.ighm.org?
If you, through that, you can get to the Seat of the People and all our other events. So please, go to Ireland's Great Hunger Institute and you can find everything.
Fabulous. Okay. All right. Again, very happy Easter to you.
And to you. Thank you.
And fancy listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.